This is Tom on Thursday, February 19, reading Bloomberg Businessweek and Bloomberg Businessweek magazine for February. U.S. deploys vast Mideast force as Trump pressures Iran. The U.S. military is deploying a vast array of forces in the Middle East, including two aircraft carriers, fighter jets, and refueling tankers, giving President Donald Trump the option for a major attack against Iran as he pressures the country to strike a deal over the nuclear program. The deployment is unlike anything the U.S. has done since 2003, when it amassed forces ahead of the invasion of Iraq. It dwarfs the military buildup that Trump ordered off the coast of Venezuela in the weeks before he ousted President Nicolas Maduro. While the U.S. isn't likely to deploy ground troops, the buildup suggests Trump is giving himself the option of a sustained campaign lasting many days in cooperation with Israel. It would look far different than the overnight strikes the U.S. launched against Iran's nuclear program last June. "Maybe we're going to make a deal," Trump said in a speech on Thursday morning. "You're going to be finding out over the next probably 10 days. The open question is whether Iran can possibly satisfy Trump's demands and whether by deploying so much military hardware to the region, Trump may feel compelled to use it rather than backing down. The weapons at Trump's disposal are formidable. The USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier is accompanied by three Arleigh Burke-class guided missile destroyers, which can carry Tomahawk missiles. The carrier's air wing includes F-35C fighter jets. The USS Gerald R. Ford, the most expensive U.S. warship ever built at $13 billion, is accompanied by guided missile destroyers, and its associated air wing includes FA-18-3 and FA-18F Super Hornets, E-2D airborne early warning aircraft, as well as MH-60S and MH-60R Seahawk helicopters and C-2A Greyhounds. The two carriers provide more options and would enable us to conduct operations on a more sustained basis, if it comes to that, said Michael Eisenstadt, director of military studies for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He said the buildup signals to the Iranians the need to be more flexible in negotiations. Trump met with his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and special envoy, Steve Witkoff, on Wednesday for an update on the negotiations with Iran. Officials met in the Situation Room on Wednesday to discuss possible action and were told to expect that all military forces deployed to the region would be in place by mid-March, according to a U.S. official. A major strike against Iran, where leaders are anxious about regime stability following widespread unrest, risks entangling the U.S. in its third war of choice in the Middle East since 1991, against a more formidable adversary than the U.S. has faced in decades. Trump's use of the military in his second term has been characterized by short and successful engagements with minimal harm to U.S. troops, including bombing Iranian nuclear targets in June, attacking alleged drug trafficking boats, and the raid that extracted Maduro in early January. But if fresh strikes on Iran prompt a wider conflagration, the president could face considerable public pressure. Trump spoke against U.S. engagements in foreign wars on the campaign trail, but has gone on to bomb Iran, Tehran-backed Houthi militants in Yemen, and militants in Syria. With Iran's air defenses largely neutralized by previous U.S. and Israel strikes, the U.S. strike fighters would operate largely with impunity over Iranian airspace, said Brian Clark, a defense analyst for the Hudson Institute and a former Navy strategy officer. "There is always the risk of downed pilots, but I think the bigger risk is to ships. The same cruise and ballistic missiles the Iranians gave to the Houthis could be turned against U.S. ships in the Persian Gulf, Arabian Sea, and Red Sea." Thousands of U.S. service members in the region are also within range of Iranian ballistic missiles, and regime officials have vowed to respond with full force to a U.S. strike. Beyond attacks on U.S. military assets, Iran could try to close the Strait of Hormuz. The narrow waterway between Oman and Iran transfers by 25% of maritime oil traffic. U.S. strikes in June 2025 focused on three sites associated with Iran's nuclear program, but a more ambitious effort to topple the regime in Iran could involve attacks on sites associated with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and potentially senior leadership, including Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. But Iran might be able to withstand such decapitation attempts. Israel already killed the top leaders of the IRGC in its opening strikes in the June war, and Iran was able to reconstitute and respond within 24 hours, said Jamal Abdi, president of the U.S.-based National Iranian American Council. They've now planned for these possibilities in future wars, and so now may be even more resilient if senior leaders are killed. White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt said Wednesday Iran was expected to offer a response to the negotiations within the next couple of weeks, but did not preclude the possibility of military action before that. The president will continue to watch how this plays out. Former Prince Andrew arrested on suspicion of misconduct. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, the brother of the UK's King Charles, has been arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office after further details emerged of his relationship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. King Charles III issued a statement outlining his deepest concern about the matter and promising Buckingham Palace's full and wholehearted support and cooperation with the investigating authorities. What now follows is the full, fair, and proper process by which this issue is investigated in the appropriate manner, Charles said. Let me state clearly, the law must take its course. The arrest of Andrew, who turned 66 on Thursday, heaps further embarrassment on Britain's royal family following years of lurid allegations about ties with Epstein that the former prince has consistently denied. His arrest appears to be the first of a UK royal since King Charles I in the 17th century, following his defeat in the English Civil War. Emails to a representative from Mountbatten Windsor's office weren't immediately returned. He has not been charged. Emails released by the U.S. Department of Justice last month showed the former prince allegedly disclosing confidential government information to Epstein during his time as UK trade envoy, a position he held between 2001 and 2011. Thames Valley Police confirmed Thursday that it had made an arrest after saying last week it was leading the assessment of allegations relating to misconduct in public office stemming from the release of those files. Photographs in the UK media appeared to show police vehicles attending the Sandringham Estate, the royal family's residence in the county of Norfolk. Norfolk police told Bloomberg that they are supporting a Thames Valley police investigation into misconduct in a public office. Misconduct in a public office carries a maximum punishment of life in prison and concerns serious, willful abuse or neglect of the power or responsibilities of the public office held, according to Crown Prosecution Service guidelines. In a 2015 Court of Appeal ruling, judges described the offense as an ancient common law offense that can trace its roots back to the 13th century. Between 2014 and 2024, some 191 people were convicted of misconduct in a public office, according to research from Spotlight on Corruption. More than 92% were prison or police officers, with only 2% of publicly identifiable convictions coming against senior public officials or executives. The Epstein files contain emails indicating that Mountbatten Windsor had advocated for Epstein on a visit with the late Queen Elizabeth II to the United Arab Emirates in 2010, and that he had shared information acquired in his trade envoy role with the disgraced financier and his associates. They also contain pictures of the former prince on all fours kneeling over a young woman. Mountbatten Windsor has previously faced separate allegations regarding sexual offenses connected to his friendship with Epstein, which prompted his mother, the late Queen, to strip him of his military titles and patronages in 2022. They included civil action in the U.S. brought by Virginia Jeffrey, who alleged that she was forced to have sex with a former prince as a teenager. He paid a financial settlement to end the court case, denying any wrongdoing. King Charles III stripped Mountbatten Windsor of his remaining titles, including prince, in September, following the publication of Jeffrey's memoir in which he said the former prince believed that having sex with me was his birthright. Despite the king's move, Mountbatten Windsor is still eighth in line to the throne. As this process continues, it would not be right for me to comment further on this matter, Charles said on Thursday. Meanwhile, my family and I will continue in our duty and service. Steve Cohen's $3.4 billion payday tops hedge fund ranks. The .72 founder edges Tepper and Englander to take the number one spot in Bloomberg's annual listing. Steve Cohen, the billionaire owner of the New York Mets, was frank about the heartbreak at Citi Field. "I owe you an apology," the hedge fund mogul tweeted to fans as the Major League Baseball team limped away from a disastrous 2025 season. Yet at that very moment, Cohen could lay claim to the Wall Street equivalent of a World Series title, hedge fund champion of champions. For the first time, Cohen tops Bloomberg's annual list of the world's best paid hedge fund managers. Cohen's take from his hedge fund, .72 Asset Management, totaled a cool $3.4 billion in 2025, according to Bloomberg calculations. That works out to more than $9 million a day, enough to buy 1 million or so Nathan's hot dogs daily for an entire year at Citi Field in Queens, or cover the annual salaries of 67 Juan Sotos, the team's most expensive player. Cohen, 69, a lifelong Mets fan, has become one of the biggest spenders in American sports. After buying the team for a record $2.4 billion in 2020, he set out to win the World Series within 3 to 5 years. That clock has run out, despite his $340 million payroll. While Mets fans were dreaming of a revival in Flushing, Cohen, a real-life inspiration for hedge funder Bobby Axelrod in the TV drama Billions, found his redemption 45 minutes north of Queens on the Connecticut Gold Coast, where .72 is based. In 2013, his then hedge fund, SAC Capital, pleaded guilty to insider trading. Cohen denied wrongdoing and was forced to return all client cash. Cohen's off-the-diamond comeback is, as Mets faithful might say, amazing. Few hedge funds or managers bounce back from such a setback, let alone so quickly. But more than $4 billion rushed into Stamford-based .72 when it reopened in 2018, and billions more have poured in every year since. Today it manages $45.7 billion in assets, putting it among the world's biggest multi-strategy hedge funds in the same league as Balyasny Asset Management's $32 billion, Citadel's $66 billion, and Millennium Management's $86.3 billion. For the first time since Bloomberg began compiling its ranking, co-invested rival Ken Griffin, founder of Citadel. Griffin, 57, earned $2.4 billion in 2025, according to Bloomberg's calculation, putting him in fifth place. David Tepper, 68, who mostly manages his own money at Appaloosa, nabbed second place with $3.2 billion, while Izzy Englander, the 77-year-old founder of Millennium Management, came in third with $3.1 billion. Cohen, Griffin, Tepper, and Englander declined to comment for this story, as did every other manager mentioned. Like its biggest competitors, Point72 has been confronting a problem that many ordinary people probably wish for. It has more money than it knows what to do with. At the beginning of last year, it turned away investors ready to fork over $9 billion. Its solution? Grow faster. In less than a decade, it has added 12 offices, more than doubled its global staff to 3,000, and expanded the number of its trading pods to more than 190. The stock-picking fund also launched a macro-investing unit, while its quant business, Cubist, has swelled to 600 employees from 225. Point72 recently began building a private credit operation and is raising its first venture fund for clients. It's also considering starting a commodities unit. In 2024, rather than lose a star portfolio manager, it allowed the trader to run his own fund internally. The first time that's happened. Eric Sanchez's Turian vehicle now has $3 billion in assets and gained 30% last year. The 20 managers on Bloomberg's ranking earned an average of $1.4 billion. That's the highest amount in the past 5 years, despite the list being expanded in 2025 to 20 names from 15. This year also marks a record for the most managers making $1 billion or more. Nearly every hedge fund made money last year as volatile equity markets propelled the industry to its best returns since 2009. Collectively, the group earned a total of $28.3 billion. The top earners tend to be long-tenured founders whose firms manage the most money and who have built up personal fortunes that are invested in the funds. Still, compared with Point72's 17.5% gain last year, other multi-strategy funds came up short. Citadel, which in recent years has posted returns of 15% to 38%, boosted by commodities, last year rose just over 10%, making its worst performance since 2018. The economic toll of uncertainty will soon be visible. The stagflation from Trump's trade and immigration policies will start showing up in data this year. Forecasters and investors misinterpret what is happening in the American economy. Some believe the uncertainty around President Donald Trump's trade and other economic policies is abating, while a loud and influential minority argue that the administration's deportations and tariffs are not causing the predicted harm. Inflation increased only modestly before coming down in 2025, they point out, while the latest data shows the economy growing at its fastest rate in 2 years. These mistaken assessments are based on a fundamental misunderstanding of how government-induced uncertainty affects the economy. This confusion makes sense because no presidential administration has imposed this kind of uncertainty on the U.S. private sectors in a century or more. The economy's solid growth due to artificial intelligence investment further muddies recognition of these unfamiliar harms. Careful analysis, however, shows the stagflationary effects of Trump's policies are kicking in and should become too evident to miss as we approach April 2, the first anniversary of his so-called Liberation Day. It should be no surprise that it takes time before the paralyzing effects of tariffs and deportations on decision-making by businesses, households, and investors start to surface in government statistics. In our analysis of the Trump economic program at the Peterson Institute, we consistently predicted that it would take at least a year before the impact was visible in macroeconomic data. My inflation forecast for 2026 is for the consumer price in product index to rise at a 4% rate, perhaps even higher, by the third quarter, up from a 2.7% rate in November, its latest reading. It may feel like a long time since Trump initiated mass deportations of undocumented immigrants and began blanketing imports with tariffs that vary widely depending on the product and country of origin. Yet businesses have had many uncertainties to resolve before deciding how much to raise prices and whether to shift supply chains. Will Trump even go through with his tariff threats? If he does, will the tariffs be negotiated away in a later deal or struck down by the courts? If the duties stick, could my business or industry secure an exemption through political lobbying or expect a rebate such as the one Trump is offering farmers? Then there are the supply chain considerations. Should I buy inputs from Mexico instead of China? Should I relocate production from China to a lesser tariff country? Should I bring production back to the U.S.? Even the largest, most sophisticated manufacturers, such as Caterpillar Inc. and Toyota Motor Corp., have been hesitant to make significant decisions on reallocating production. And if the biggest companies, those with the most extensive analytical resources and global experiences, are hesitant, how long will it take for small and medium-sized businesses to react? Companies also bought time when they stocked up imports ahead of Trump's trade war. But once those stockpiles run out, as has happened pretty much across the economy by now, they will be forced to pass on their higher costs to consumers. Just as unprecedented tariffs take time to work through the economy because of lags in decision-making, so does a radical shift in U.S. immigration policy. The Trump administration claims to have deported about 1 million undocumented immigrants over the first year of his second term. But what looks like the world's most boring graph tells a different story. Those flat lines show that employment levels in the U.S. industries that are most dependent on undocumented labor, such as health and child care, agriculture, food processing, and residential construction, have remained essentially unchanged since Trump took office again. This implies that large numbers of undocumented workers have not left yet. Although tracking undocumented labor is inherently difficult, government data do not reveal a substantial number of native-born or foreign-documented workers moving into these industries. These occupations have poor working conditions, pay low wages, and offer little or no benefits, which is why they are dominated by migrant workers. To introduce legal workers to take these jobs, employers would have to pay more, yet wages in those industries have not been rising. Robots are not ready, and machines are not cost-efficient enough to replace low-cost human workers in areas like fruit and vegetable harvesting, home health and child care services, poultry processing, exposed mining, and home construction. In any event, a surge in labor-saving investment in automation in these subsectors would be visible in the data, and there has been none. Just as businesses need time to adjust to the Trump administration's policies, so too do undocumented families. Think through the decisions they must make under this uncertainty. And that explains the delayed departures and lagging macroeconomic impact. First, Will Trump really follow through on his deportation threats? Will immigration officers come after me in my neighborhood or at my workplace? If they do, how much can I earn before then? Should I leave on my own so I can apply for legal residency later? Do I take my family or not? Employers that rely on undocumented labor have their own decisions to make. Arguably, many businesses chose to risk U.S. immigration and custom enforcement raids because they could pay even less while their workers were under threat and put off searching for new ones, albeit at some cost in employee turnover and no-shows. At some point in 2026, we should expect the reality to catch up with the administration's claimed net outflow of migrants. Though that number will include a lot of documented immigrants as well. When it does, there will be short changes in some parts of the job market, forcing employers to raise wages to fill vacancies and thus adding to inflationary pressures. Home health care costs, for example, are rising at a 12% annual rate, according to the latest data, near the highest in decades. This could push some working women into part-time work or out of the labor force entirely to care for family members, as happened during the pandemic, though on a smaller scale. Decision-making under uncertainty also explains the clear duality of investment in the U.S. economy, with AI and related industries seeing a substantial rise and the rest of the economy showing near-zero growth. The building boom in AI-related infrastructure is a prime example of what Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Solow called exogenous technological progress. Typically, the advent of a new technology powering an expansion independent of the normal economic cycle. Capital expenditures on data centers, advanced chips, and other AI gear were the principal driver of the expansion in gross domestic product in the second and third quarters of 2025. But why should private investment in the rest of the economy be so weak when the tax code is becoming more favorable toward it, thanks in part to provisions in Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, when real interest rates are low by historical standards and likely headed lower, courtesy of the Federal Reserve, when corporate balance sheets are solid and private credit is widely available, when energy prices are falling, when deregulation is proceeding, and when corporate mergers are no longer blocked as they were under the Biden administration. Normally, one would expect corporate investment to boom under these circumstances. Again, policy-induced uncertainty is largely to blame. Beside the changes to trade and immigration policies, the Trump administration's corrosion of past U.S. norms regarding the rule of law, government corruption and self-dealing, technocratic provision of economic and scientific data, and central bank independence all take their toll. As the economic theorists Avinash Dixit and Robert Pindyke have shown, business managers tend to respond to rising uncertainty by dialing back on capital outlays for things like new factories, because such expenditures are largely irreversible. The U.S. under Trump is potentially facing a situation like the U.K. did in the aftermath of the Brexit referendum of 2016, which caused private investment to flatline for several years, depressing growth. AI investment and the plausible productivity gains resulting from it may well offset a lot of the contraction from the effect of tariffs and deportations taking hold in 2026. In fact, stimulus from the ongoing AI boom and looser fiscal policies will compound the inflationary pressures from Trump's trade and immigration policies as shortages of labor and imported inputs become more widespread. That the full effect of Trump's program are not yet visible doesn't mean that mainstream economics was wrong. Rather, it's indicative of the way uncertainty delays or even paralyzes decision-making. In context, the path ahead for Venezuelan oil. Rusty pipelines, unchecked spills, decades of chronic underinvestment, brain drain, and mismanagement. Venezuela's oil industry is in shambles, and restoring it to its former glory would cost an estimated $100 billion, if big oil would even want to undertake such a risky repair job. Also, the crude in Venezuela's vast reserves is viscous and difficult to extract, and it would be slow to reach the market in significant volumes, in some cases taking as long as a decade. That's too late to offer much in the way of lower prices during the remainder of President Donald Trump's term. So why is he pushing so hard to bring it back? He wants any price relief he can get, sure. But anyone watching the supply and demand forecast also knows it makes long-term strategic sense. The world is going to need a lot more oil in 2030 and 2040 than previously expected if current consumption patterns hold, and its biggest supplier, the U.S., is about to see its own output plateau. No one agrees exactly when world oil production will peak, especially as offshore discoveries and the expanded use of fracking promise to prolong the fossil fuel's lifespan. But the growth in shale oil production that propelled the U.S. from being a net energy importer to the world's number one supplier is nearing its end. Other fast-growing producers in the Americas, Canada, Brazil, and Guyana, are expected to max out by the early 2030s, then go into decline. Globally, the industry needs to spend a startling $540 billion a year looking for oil and gas just to keep output at current levels by 2050, according to the International Energy Agency. If investments are limited to maintaining existing oil fields, production will nearly halve by 2040, according to Bloomberg NEF. At the same time, oil consumption continues to break records, even as the world grapples with the increasingly destructive effects of climate change. To avert the worst damage, experts agree, society needs to wean itself off fossil fuels immediately. But while a decline in oil demand came tantalizingly into view during the pandemic, fossil fuel consumption has since roared back, in part because of the slow deployment of renewables and the swelling power needs from artificial intelligence and of the electrification of everything. Together, these dynamics threaten to push the oil market, today quite well supplied, into a shortage over the next decade. The U.S. doesn't need the oil at the moment, says Marcelo de Assis, an oil consultant. Trump's push into Venezuela is more like a hedge for the future. Before the U.S. military's capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the world had mostly written off the founding of OPEC member in terms of oil supply. Years of political turmoil, corruption, and expropriations left it producing less than a third of peak levels, with little hope of a turnaround. Then Trump ordered the operation against Maduro and demanded full access to Venezuela's oil reserve from the replacement leadership. He's spoken boldly of the world's biggest oil companies descending on the Caribbean country to fix its industry within 18 months. Just seizing control and lifting sanctions on oil shipments would add some marginal barrels to today's oversupplied crude market, potentially bringing prices down a hair from their roughly four-year low. That could notch a symbolic win for Trump, who repeatedly pledged to lower energy costs during his presidential campaign. The first wave of companies eager to tackle Venezuela's rundown oil sector will resemble the less conventional risk-takers that are already there. Small producers with low overhead that can profit from restarting minor fields. These kinds of investment will increase production by only about 300,000 barrels a day over the next 2 to 3 years to 1.4 million barrels a day, according to consulting firm Rystad Energy AS. To return to 3 million barrels a day, roughly Kuwait's output, it will cost $12 billion a year and take until 2040. We're going to have sustained $100 a barrel price in the mid-2030s with a market totally dominated by the Saudis, says Schreiner Parker, head of emerging markets and national oil companies at Rystad. That is, unless you have a Western Hemisphere counterbalance to that production, and that's Venezuela. The level of ramp-up in oil output Trump envisions would require the majors to get involved in a big way. While the world's largest oil companies are always eager to secure more reserves, especially with peak U.S. production on the horizon, many have been burned before. In 1946, the year Trump was born, Chevron made one of Venezuela's biggest oil discoveries, the Boscan Field, joining Exxon and Shell as operators in what was then the world's second biggest producer, delivering 15% of global oil supply that year. Then in 1976, Venezuela carried out a nationalization of its oil industry amid a wider move by oil-rich countries to take control of their natural resources. Chevron lost its prize Buscan Field. Exxon and Shell lost even more. In the 1990s, Venezuela invited oil companies back. Many returned, with Chevron going on to invest billions of dollars to develop the tar oil region in eastern Venezuela that makes the country the largest holder of oil reserves. Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, launched another nationalization campaign in the mid-2000s, forcing big oil corporations to accept a lower share of profits or have their properties seized. Massive oil infrastructure was taken like we were babies, and we didn't do anything about it, Trump said following Maduro's capture. Chevron Corp is the only big U.S. company that stayed. ExxonMobil Corp and ConocoPhillips left. U.S. oil companies still have outstanding arbitration awards worth billions. For oil companies, the safe environment in which they could invest is when and if Venezuela has a democratic, stable, market-friendly, and pro-Western government, says Jimena Zuniga, an analyst at Bloomberg Economics. There's no better motivation for companies than when they have a high-reward and low-risk opportunity. Asked about plans for Venezuela, a spokesperson for ConocoPhillips says it's monitoring developments in Venezuela, but that it would be premature to speculate on any future business activities or investments. Exxon declined to comment. Chevron declined to comment on whether it planned to boost its investment there, noting that it's focused on the safety and well-being of our employees, as well as the integrity of our assets. Big producers have other reasons to trade cautiously. International oil giants have been consolidated and streamlining operations amid low prices, and it's more expensive to produce crude under the existing terms in Venezuela than in Brazil or Guyana. Estimates vary, but Rystad's chief economist, Claudio Galimberti, calculates the country as an average break-even price as high as $80 a barrel, given the prolonged dearth of investment, costlier than that of many producing basins across the Americas. Venezuela's oil is also higher in sulfur and denser, gloopier even, than crude from other regions, requiring diluents and special equipment to process it. Given the hurdles, there's not an insignificant chance that this could all fall apart, and oil companies know that. Trump would like to see the majors, but I don't think they're in a rush, says Carlos Bellerin, an executive vice president at Welligence Energy Analytics. The fiscal incentives would have to be so good to compensate for the political risk. Still, the opportunity could prove enticing for oil majors looking at the longer term. After all, the U.S.'s move away from electric vehicles and clean energy under Trump means it might be reliant on outside sources of oil in the coming decades. And for companies that have stepped up international exploration over the past year with a view to bulking up production after 2030, the opening of Venezuela could prove a game changer. Although pumping and burning all that oil will have enormous consequences for the world's climate, in the eyes of big oil, says Rystad's Parker, it might be too big a resource to leave in the ground. Hiring a human just got harder. Artificial intelligence is evolving so quickly, corporate executives don't fully know what it can and cannot do. But it has already made them think twice about hiring actual people. We're adopting the Elon Musk philosophy. You really have to make a good case to bring another human being into our organization, Kathy Wood, founder of ARK Investment Management, LLC, told reporters this fall. E-commerce platform Shopify, Inc. has mandated for months that managers wanting to hire must demonstrate why they cannot get what they want done using AI. Jeremy Barnum, chief financial officer at J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, described on recent earnings call a very strong bias against hiring more people whenever the bank identifies a new need. We know that even if we can't always measure it that precisely, he said, there are definitely productivity tailwinds from AI. Most companies don't face a blanket ban on adding staff, and many are still hiring for roles considered necessary for growth, such as engineering and sales. But with the rapid acceleration of generative AI, management is casting a more critical eye on any role it could potentially farm out to the likes of ChatGPT instead, including the entry-level ones that have traditionally trained the next generation of workers. When companies do hire, it comes with more friction and fewer approvals. They're not saying no to headcount, but they're trying to be thoughtful, says Peter Walker, head of insights at Carta, a platform that tracks ownership stakes in startups. Everyone's asking, how much can be done with AI? It's not merely a question of controlling costs. Keeping a lid on headcount forces existing employees to get creative with AI tools, exploring novel ways to boost productivity. They may find uses even their IT departments can't foresee. But the technology's fast-changing nature makes long-range staff planning difficult. Even as companies redesign workflows around AI tools, the tech's capabilities keep shifting, says Katie George, Corporate Vice President for Workforce Transformation at Microsoft Corp. No one's ever been good at workforce planning, truth be told, and it's getting much harder, she says. It's pretty hard to see exactly what roles will exist even a year from now. For entry-level workers, particularly new college graduates, the implications are dire. The U.S. shed more than 1.2 million jobs in 2025, according to outplacement company Challenger Gray & Christmas. That's the highest number of annual job cut announcements since 2020. AI was one of the top reasons cited for reductions, with tech blamed for tens of thousands more job cuts last year than bankruptcies were. There are roles that they're just not requesting anymore, says Kamala Matias-Morey, Chief Operating Officer at corporate credit card company Brex, Inc. Customer service managers are seeking approval for fewer entry-level hires, she says. Brex still recruits some junior staff, but fast-tracks training so they're ready for more advanced roles in 3 months. Some executives, scarred by the mass layoffs following the pandemic-era hiring binge, rationalize that putting hiring decisions under a microscope is sort of a kindness. Being vigilant now is the key to avoiding future job cuts. Caitlin Kamm, who leads the human resources team in San Francisco at Office Space Management Platform Envoy, recently implemented a much more rigorous process to evaluate managers' hiring requests, requiring them to write a memo that clearly outlined the business case and specific success metrics for each role. She estimates the process lengthens the hiring guide timeline by 3 weeks. At Duolingo Inc., sometimes the best solution to emerging AI is bringing in a contractor instead of a full-time employee, says Deepika Bhattacharya, head of people. It's not that we need it, but let's think critically about what we can be doing to simplify, she says. Another popular strategy is to hit pause on hiring to wait and see how the tech evolves. This is what's happening inside certain departments at HubSpot Inc., according to Helen Russell, the software maker's chief people officer. Given all the unknowns, the company is trying to buy us more time to be able to see what will materialize, she says. Sometimes the best answer is to take a beat. Let's hold and let's just reassess this 3 months from now. Still, AI's rapid advances have created demand for at least one human role that didn't exist before. An in-house expert to evaluate every AI startup promising an industry-redefining invention. At file-sharing platform Box Inc., co-founder and CEO Aaron Levy has tapped his chief of staff to stay on top of it all. On any given week, there's a breakthrough that could alter your entire strategy, he says. So if you don't have somebody deeply paying attention to all the contours of this industry right now, you're at a very steep disadvantage. Who to call to become a bank? Want to be a bank? Call the Alts. Michelle Alt, her husband Conrad, and 8 other partners at Claros Group LLC have become the go-to shepherds for the deluge of financial companies newly pursuing U.S. bank charters under the Trump administration and its looser regulations. Founded in 2019, Claros got its first business bump during Joe Biden's presidency when regulators cracked down on financial technology companies and their bank partners, driving firms to seek out Claros guidance. But it's never been busier than in the past year. More than 30 companies have submitted applications for bank charters since President Donald Trump returned to the White House, with far more in the pipeline. Claros says it's working on roughly a dozen charter-related projects at the moment. The firm's clients have included SmartBiz Bank NA, the first fintech under the new Trump administration to get approval to buy a bank, as well as Nissan Motor Company's financing arm and Brazil's Nubank. Cristina Junquera, a Nubank co-founder and its chief growth officer, describes the U.S. charter application process as a monumental undertaking that requires absolute precision, and one that's much simpler to pull off with the help of Claros. It's a niche corner of business, but highly in demand these days as would-be banks race to secure a charter which, among other perks, might allow them to accept deposits and then reinvest them, offering a cheap and reliable form of funding. A charter also eliminates reliance on a third party to offer banking services, which has been an issue under past administrations and regulatory scrutiny of relationships between fintechs and their banking partners. While companies, including Block Inc., landed banking licenses during Trump's first term, not a single new or de novo fintech charter was issued under Biden, prompting the current sense of urgency. Critics say some of the companies trying to snag an easier-to-get charter may introduce problematic risk into the financial system. The Bank Policy Institute, a lobbying group, has expressed concerns about applications from digital asset companies. In December, 5 crypto firms, BitGo, Circle, Paxos, Ripple, and Fidelity's digital asset arm, received preliminary regulatory approval to perform certain banking functions. None of those companies worked with Claros on their applications, it says. Allowing firms to choose a lighter regulatory touch while offering bank-like products could blur the statutory boundary of what it means to be a bank, the lobbying group said in an October statement. That could even bring heightened systemic risk and even undermine the credibility of the national banking charter itself. The alts see it from a different angle. If a company wants to act like a bank, then it should be regulated like a bank, Michelle says. A charter gives it direct relationship to its regulators and helps advisors get a cleaner view into its operations. That said, we don't work with somebody that we don't want as part of the banking system, she says. I know this sounds corny, but we at Claros, especially the founders and the partners, care deeply about the integrity of the bank regulatory system. That's where many of us grew up, right? The median bill for working with Claros is about $250,000, typically a flat fee based on the scope of the work, and the firm avoids projects with budgets of less than $100,000, with the occasional exception. Claros also tacks a no-assholes clause into all its contracts, which the partners say is strictly enforced. If you're an old dude like me or Conrad, you've earned the ability through your career to work with people you enjoy, says partner and co-founder Brian Graham, who first met Conrad while working on Capitol Hill in the late 1980s. Graham, the alts, and another friend, Adam Shapiro, founded the firm together a few months after the alts got married. Claros basically started in the same way our fintech clients start, almost like a few guys in a garage, Michelle says. Part of Claros' draw is the partners themselves, starting with Michelle and Conrad, who don't fit the typical tech world or Washington upstart mold. Michelle is 60, Conrad is 65, and many of the other partners have gray hair. Conrad, a musician, bust in San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf and Girardelli Square in the late 1970s, long before his latest career track. Michelle sports a nose ring and a tattoo of her mother's name on her right wrist. Echoing the Brady Bunch, they merged their families of three children each, bringing them together the same year they founded Claros. Since the beginning of November, Claros has announced two new hires, bringing the firm's headcount to about 40 advisors, partners, and other staffers. Derek Higginbotham, a former fintech bank executive chief officer, stepped into a partner role this past fall, and Roman Goldstein, a former staffer at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, joined as a senior director. The hirings underscore that Claros doesn't only handle bank charter applications. Rather, its designed, build, fix mantra encompasses everything from risk management consultation to bank examination handholding. Still, licensing was the biggest practice area last year and will continue to account for about a third of total revenue, though the largest source varies from year to year, Conrad says. A registered Democrat, Michelle says she's found the Trump White House far easier to deal with. She spent the 2024 holiday season drafting a white paper on issues related to bank charter applications and published it as an open letter to the new administration. Since then, she says there have been significant improvements in communication in comparison with the Biden years. Now the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, one of the federal agencies that approves bank charters, is presenting fintechs with a lifeline for review and sticking to those timelines, a welcome improvement, Michelle says. The name Claros sounds a bit like clarity, and that's a useful thing to have when you're a fintech weighing a major strategic decision. You can read the regulations, you can read the guidance, Conrad says, but there's an awful lot of unwritten lore and practical knowledge that you're just not going to get out of those documents. Washington is rewiring capital. Trump administration is changing the way money flows through the U.S. economy, Some of the president's actions have struck at the banks that underpin the nation's financial system, and others have nudged savers toward new investments whose merits will take decades to judge. These changes will reroute hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars in capital in the coming years, with winners and losers along the way. Banks. In the U.S., banks are required to hold a certain amount of capital relative to their assets, regardless of how risky those assets are. The rule known as the Enhanced Supplementary Leverage Ratio, or ESLR, was implemented in 2014 as a backstop against other banking regulations. But banks have long complained that it prevents them from trading as many treasuries as they'd like. In November, federal regulators moved to relax the rule, lowering the asset ratio from 5% to between 3.5% and 4.25% for major lenders and even less for their subsidiaries. The changes, which take effect in early 2026, may incentivize big banks to plow more capital into the government debt market. Critics argue they'll make the system more fragile by reducing capital buffers and giving big institutions an even greater competitive advantage over smaller ones. Crypto. As recently as 2019, Donald Trump said cryptocurrencies are based on thin air. Since then, digital assets have transformed his family's fortune, and his second administration has embraced crypto like none before. The Genius Act, a law regulating stablecoins tied to the U.S. dollar that Trump signed in July, has opened the door to mainstream stablecoin adoption by big banks. The market is projected to grow to as much as $4 trillion by 2030 from about $310 billion today, according to Citi Institute. All the activity is helping mint new crypto riches. Some experts warn the growth could come at the expense of small banks as people transfer money from deposit accounts into digital assets. 401ks. U.S. residents have traditionally invested their 401k dollars in stocks and bonds, but in August, Trump signed an executive order directing the government to reevaluate guidance for retirement savings investing in alternative assets such as private equity. With $13 trillion currently held in 401ks and other defined contribution accounts, the move is poised to open up hundreds of billions of dollars in capital for the $18 trillion alternative investment industry. There's nothing currently stopping a retirement manager from offering private assets in their investment lineup, but companies have avoided it out of legal fear of taking too much risk with employees' savings. The new order could lead to a revision of rules that gives legal cover to plan administrators looking to expand in the sector. Private equity leaders have said this would democratize access to products that only a small number of investors have had access to. Detractors such as Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren have warned that adding alternative assets to 401ks will expose Americans to high-cost, risky investments. Asked for comment on all these changes, White House spokesman Kush Desai said in an email that President Trump pledged to restore America as the most dynamic economy in the world, and the administration is committed to cutting the red tape to deliver.